Hello and welcome everyone to the podcast you thought had been canceled, but it's still here. It's coming back. And that's MTG Potpourri, a Sometimes Magic-related podcast.
Don't call it a comeback.
Well, it's not a comeback. We never went away. We just took hiatus. Don't call it a comeback. It's like Jurassic World to Jurassic Park, Jurassic World. There was a break, but the movies keep coming. We're going to ignore 2 and 3 in the middle. We have MTG Potpourri and MTG Potpourri.
So I haven't seen the new one. Is it worth it?
It's actually quite good. You have to take my opinion with a grain of salt these days.
Adam instantly was like, I'm not too sure if Tom's opinion is valid here.
I did enjoy Zombiever, so both. And it wasn't actually my poor taste in movies I was alluding to. It's that when you get like one date night every 3 to 4 months and you could see that one movie, you usually enjoy it. It's like... And you can't argue that it was number one in the box office now for 4 straight weeks since it's come out, and it's already the 5th highest grossing movie of all time.
I mean, those are all facts.
In a month. And Chris Pratt is truly a badass.
Yeah, as long as they never keep correcting numbers for inflation, the highest grossing is always going to be whatever big movie comes out and next year and the year after. Like, there's never going to be a year where it's not a new highest grossing movie.
Well, no, it's number five. Avatar still has them all beat to shit still. Avatar is number one by like $500 million at like $2.6 billion.
Oh, that's great.
Adam's very thrilled about this.
Number two is Titanic. So again, if you adjust that for inflation, God knows where it would be.
So if you're James Cameron, you're having a good life. That's basically what
it is. Yes, it is pretty impressive when that same guy has number one and number two of all time. I think together it would be $4.5 billion or something like that.
Sure.
Two movies.
I mean, he's got a formula.
He does. But guys, this is not a movie podcast. I'm
like, no, it's
podcast.
Not.
This is a magic podcast.
How do you possibly know that?
Oh, you wait. I have the ultimate tangent breaker of all time, which comes from...
That. I don't even know what a tangent breaker is, but I don't know what a phone to find out.
This comes from... Well, let's talk about magic, then I'll bring up how we tried to discuss World War II with my 3.5-year-old and where that went. It was a deep well.
It
makes sense.
Let's go to the magic.
Yeah, let's get into the magic, and then we're going to dive into World War II from the eyes of a 3.5-year-old, because it is fascinating, like, what I said and then what regurgitated from her mouth like 30 minutes later was fantastic.
All
right. Origins. We have a new set coming out this weekend.
Is it a Magic the Gathering set?
It is.
Oh my gosh.
It is full. It's kind of weird that the Origins has reprints, but it is has a lot of original
cards. Well, it is. Origins is sort of kind of the last core set ever.
Yeah.
When I say sort of kind of, I mean...
Well, they alluded that.
In timing, in kind of sort of feel... It's a core set, but at the same time, it breaks a lot of core set rules. It has new keywords, which core sets generally don't have. It's got like a lot of advanced mechanics that are going to...
Flipside of Planeswalkers. Take that.
Flipside of Planeswalkers is obviously very, very unique. But also, there's just like the cards that are in this set are just going to impact competitive Magic in huge ways, which I'll talk about a little bit when I talk about some of my cards. But I don't know. It's a really interesting set in that it's kind of an advanced level, like block, basically like just like Innistrad or Khan's Atark here. But then it has a little bit of a throwback to the core set. And then from here on out, we won't have core sets. We're doing 2 blocks a year of whatever advanced sets there are. So
hey, before we jump into the cards, I mean, do you guys feel sad about, I guess, our sort of the classic way Magic sets have come out with, you know, blocks, core set? Or do you feel like the core set just doesn't necessarily have that place anymore? Are you happy this will give them, I guess, more other sets they can release in a year?
I mean, I don't think anybody was ever super excited about base editions. And,
oh, 8th edition whiteboarder? Oh,
yeah, Choke is like... I mean, the reason cards like Choke and Blood Moon are $1 million are like not just because they happen to do something incredibly destructive and powerful and modern, but because nobody opened those sets. They just sat there. It was not very interesting. People never really did the reprints. And so, like, the whole 2010, 2011 thing, like, that was actually, like, it felt really new and exciting because, wow, we're getting new cards. But that kind of slavish, like, we need to do a new core set every year, we need to come up with a bunch of reprints every year. Like I don't think anybody's going to really miss sets that are like 40% or 30% or 60% cards that they've seen before. Like I think the idea of virtually all new sets every time isn't anything that. Thanks.
Adam, don't ruin this for me. Let me,
isn't
I need this.
People are going to miss.
Let me have this.
Isn't anything people are going to feel like they're losing something out to? Because any card that was in like Magic 2010 or like Magic Origins now can also appear in some other set.
Yeah, that's,
right. It's not like it has to be in like a core set. And like that's what I mean. Is I don't feel like we're losing something. I feel like we're just changing how we get the new stuff.
But Stormcrow,
and it's
going
to make it much
Stormcrow
more fun to get the new stuff.
Stormcrow is not going to die. Basically, what's happening is. So if you look at the core sets since Magic 2010, which are arguably four or five of the best core sets ever, what they've been trying to do is get closer and closer to being an actual set.
Yeah, more original cards.
They have more and more original cards, more and more gimmicks like gold or legendaries or whatever. They put things in them that normal sets have to make people excited about the cards. So we've been inching towards this for a while now. So all we're doing really is replacing those half-guaranteed reprints with half cards that could be reprints or could be new cards. That's all that's happening because their restrictions on reprints are so much looser these days. They're willing to put 10, 20 reprints in an advanced set and not care. Look how many times Cancel's been reprinted and Banishing Light and like all the removal spells and the artifact removal and the shatters or whatever. Like they put that stuff in every set. There's a Masterize in every single set. They don't care anymore. They're like, we'll reprint this 7 times in Standard. It doesn't matter to us. Whereas back in the day, it was like, okay, we need our one Naturalize, put it in the core set so it's guaranteed there and then we'll figure the rest out. And it was just a different world of how constructive Magic was shaped, and these days everything's kind of available, so just have another advanced set. They have more flavor, which is nice. They tend to be better sellers because people have connections to the worlds and stuff that are going on and the stories that are taking place, and core sets are always removed from that. They just always have this isolated little, like, here's some cards, hope you enjoy them. And even when they're cool cards, they're not an advanced level set.
So I'm hearing, I mean, it was part of Magic's history, but now they've sort of bled this stuff into to the other advanced sets. And we don't and just that the idea of an advanced set.
Yeah, like core sets are damage on the stack. Like they're cool for nostalgic purposes, but they really don't serve a purpose anymore. And we could do things more efficiently without them. So,
all right, so let's enjoy this, guys. I'm sad we only get two cards to talk about, but let's do this.
Tom, if you really need a third card, we'll think about it.
Think about how many cards mention Thopter tokens, and that's
there are,
where my limit's coming
some
from.
Some of those are super boring, though. It's like a 2-2
Thopter tokens.
But Thopter,
you know what one card is super interesting, super awesome, that mentions Thopter artifact creature token with flying?
What's that?
A haste one?
No, if you steal my enchantment one, I'm going to be mad at you.
No, the enchantment one's
better. Better than that, Gyarapurg Gearycrafter. Not even that? Saying that right.
I don't even know what this card is.
It is the red.
Oh, yeah, the red guy, yeah. Just because it's a terrible name.
So one of the cards that I really, really liked from Fate Reforged was Stanstep Outcast, and it was a 2/1 for 2 and a white, and when it entered the battlefield, you either chose to put a +1/+1 counter on it, so you got a 3/2 for 3, which is okay, or you could put a 1/1 flying white spirit token onto the battlefield. And that was like the option chose, like, I don't know, probably like in 99% of games that was cast in all of Magic. Like, very, very rarely did you want a +1/+1 counter on it. Like, you almost always wanted that spirit. And so basically they just took the best mode and reprinted it in red. So you get a 2/1 and a 1/1 flying.
I don't understand how that's your card over Thopter Engineer, which is like the way cooler version of the same card. It even costs 3 mana.
But you get a 1/3.
Yeah, you get a 1/3 and a 1/1 with haste, and all your artifacts get haste.
Right. So that's the uncommon one. But the reason I like the common more is because I get to stick it in my cube. That's why.
Okay.
So that's just like my cube standout of the set, the obligatory common that I'm super pumped about. But the uncommon seems super awesome. I also like the blue red uncommon that also has haste itself, which is really weird. But when it comes in, it just domes somebody for all the artifacts. That's going to kill people in Commander, and it's going to be hilarious. So
Or you did your two picks. You just totally kind of.
I was just playing off what Conley was saying. My pick is gear per gear crafter.
Okay, that one surprises me. I'm going to go next. I picked one because it's very rare that I get a card that replaces one of my most personal favorite iconic cards of all time. That was Cataclysm. Cataclysm, one of my all-time favorite cards. So did you guys take a close look at Tragic Arrogance, which in a lot of ways is pretty much superior to Cataclysm in almost all ways? It's a little bit more. Cataclysm was later. Let me put the actual errata text for Cataclysm because, you know, Lord knows I could talk about cats for all I know on that card these days.
But for those of you that don't know what Tragic Arrogance does, is it's 3 and double white for a sorcery. For each player, you choose from among the permanents that player controls.
Bam! Effect, better!
A creature, an enchantment, and a planeswalker.
And play.
Then each player sacrifices all other permanents he or she controls. Non-land permanents.
Yes, so this was, because I love Cataclysm, but it was an old card. So it said, each player chooses from among the permanents he or she controls an artifact, a creature, an enchantment, a land, and sacks the rest. So the nice thing about Cataclysm is it wiped out all planeswalkers, but obviously didn't let you potentially keep one for yourself.
No, the nice thing about Cataclysm, Tom, that you might be missing is that it killed lands. Tragic Arrogance is not.
Yeah, killed. It's not land permanents, but I would say from the usual decks I was playing, you're playing it more for the creature and everything else wiping.
Oh, sure. For competitive play, the land part was very important.
Yes, because I used to play this in my Nomad tribal deck for Cataclysm, so it liked having the lands nuked, but this wasn't necessarily crucial.
Sure.
Would it be nice to be able to kind of strategically keep a planeswalker and a few other things in, especially when you get to pick. That's what I really liked. You're right, it doesn't nuke lands, which a lot of times was a kick in the balls.
But, I mean, they moved away from those types of cards, so I understand why they did it.
Yeah, I guess there has not been. I mean, they've kind of said that land destruction wasn't fun for pretty much anybody involved.
I had a lot of fun with land destruction, Tom. So.
I bet you were probably one of those douchebags that played like Wildfire and everything else. And
I mean, I literally played it 4 copies of Wildfire at my first ever Grand Prix, and it was extended, and it was awesome. And Wildfire was not a thing. I was the first person to play Cloud Post Vesuva with my Wildfire, sir.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep 4 lands and make a million mana.
Well, I would even keep just like 1 or 2 lands and then Crucible Worlds out things later or whatever. This week. All right, you done with your card?
I'm done with my first card, yes.
A lame-o card. All right, I'm going to go with the card that I've identified that I'm going to use, and that is Demonic Pact. So this is a bit of a interesting one to wrap your head around. So I'm going to be slow, but hopefully everybody's seen the card.
Well, I already knew that.
Yeah. 2 colorless, 2 black, 4 total mana, enchantment. At the beginning of your upkeep, choose one of the following that you have not chosen yet, or that has not been chosen.
So get out your Sharpie.
So our first option is Demonic Pact deals 4 damage to a creature player, and you gain 4 life. Our second option is target opponent discards 2 cards. Third option is draw 2 cards. And our fourth option is exile a graveyard from the game. Oh, wait, no, it's you lose the game. I read that wrong. Sorry, you lose the game. That's the fourth option. Tom, you're supposed to come in here and say something to let me transition out of that.
What, that you just totally messed up? I'm going to let you sit in it.
No, I intend... Jesus, Tom. All right. Anyway. But I don't know. I love this card from a design standpoint. Like, this is one of those cards that I would have designed, like, this style of card or whatever for one of the games I'm working on. Like, I love this interesting kind of... there's, like, a puzzle here for gameplay-wise. And also a puzzle from flavor perspective, because you're like, okay, this clearly, like, they didn't just put these things on a card. Like, this card tells a story, and you almost, without even knowing a single thing about the Magic world, you can kind of figure out a story here. Like, there's, you know, somebody making a deal with, in this case, it's called Demonic Pact. You would normally see Devil, probably, but somebody making a deal with a demon, and they, you know, get these positives, and they have to give up their life, etc. Or they have to give up their soul or whatever it is. And you can kind of like put that all on the card and get there from a flavor perspective, despite all the abilities, like almost like them discarding 2 cards, you drawing 2 cards, dealing 4 damage and gaining 4 life. Those things can almost be any 3 abilities. Like those 3 abilities aren't directly tied to the story and you could still get there, which is awesome. And then from a gameplay perspective, it's just a really cool card to think about. You basically are on a 4-turn clock if you don't do anything with this. and you know, you gain a ton of advantage over those first three turns. But then you have a million ways to get rid of this as well. You can obviously like Vanishing Light it. You can bounce it. You can donate it to your opponent using like a Daring Thief or something and make them lose the game. There's like all kinds of fun little combos you can do with this card. So I expect this to be quite popular in basically every circle, casual and competitive, just because it's really, really interesting and has a lot of abuse cases, which is cool.
I mean, obviously, it depends on the game state. Do you feel like which of the three abilities do you think is the strongest? I'm gonna give you the. I'm not gonna let you mess up too much. So I'm not gonna give you the lose the game option to choose.
No, it's probably just draw cards because that's the most universally good. You're just like if you don't know what you're gonna do, you're just gonna draw two cards. But the discard two, you're basically gonna pick whenever you can get most value off. If your opponent has two cards in hand, you're almost always gonna choose that mode. Or if you're trying to get around a counter spell or something, you're gonna choose that mode. But the drawing two cards is just. There's almost never a time where you're like, I don't want to draw two cards here, where there are plenty of times where it's like, you know, dealing four, gaining four, like going to your face, I guess, maybe like, but if they have a planeswalker out all of a sudden, now that's something I'm very interested in. So it's very game state dependent, I would say.
It is a neat card. I feel like we haven't really had a flavor like this on a card before.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a pretty unique design from that perspective.
Is this something, I mean, do you feel like this was cool because it was a sort of one-off special, or would you like to see this, like you said, almost like a story in a card? It's not just, you're not getting a story from flavor text, but...
Well, I mean, you're not going to always, like, the times where you get a home run flavor to functionality match, or you can't always do that. A lot of times the cards that we get really impressed with, like the Djinn of Wishes or whatever, like that type of card, is actually like a B+ because, I guess Djinn of Wishes might be an A just because the idea of like a random card coming off the top is kind of cool. But there are plenty of cards that you kind of have to make a little bit of a leap and they're not 100% there and we still go with it. We're like Blazing Torch, for example, like very cool flavor that it's dealing 2 damage and you're throwing the torch or whatever, but why can a zombie pick up a Blazing Torch? Like, would it kill it? Or is it, does it take extra damage? Like, you know, there's like little things, or the One-Eyed Scarecrow, like why does One-Eyed Scarecrow why is he a 2/3? Why does he have 2 power if he can't attack? Like, what Scarecrow have power but can, and then why can a Blazing Scarecrow pick up the, or why can a One-Eyed Scarecrow pick up a Blazing Torch and throw it? And there's like little things like that where if you get too nitpicky you kind of ruin it. So this is just one of those cards where I think that flavor wise and functionality wise they just kind of hit head on and meet in a spot that makes a really awesome card, and you probably get one or two of those a set, but this is just one of the more memorable ones for me. But it was, as I had pointed out before the cast, this was a You Make the Card inspiration from... It was an individual. It was the Great Designer Search, right? Not You Make the Card?
I think it was You Make the Card.
Was it? Okay. I thought it might have been Great Designer Search. I couldn't remember. But either way, there was a very similar templated card, the idea of like choosing as you go along. But yeah, pretty cool.
All right. Adam, I think we're back to you.
So this is my commander pick, and this is one that I'm kind of happy to see the direction this is going in, although I'm a little worried it's kind of a flavor choice. I don't know whether the design influenced the flavor or like the flavor kind of influenced the design, but it is Possessed Scab. It's a 3 and a blue and a black for a 3/2 zombie. When it enters the battlefield, you return an instant sorcery or creature card from your graveyard to your hand, but when it dies, you exile it. And so like the flavor text is a Stitcher's attempt at a scab with a soul, and it's basically just like this zombie Hulk guy, but with like a Victorian pseudoscience Innistrad type tank with like a possessed soul inside of it. So like
it reminds me of a Big Daddy, like, when I see this from BioShock. I think a Big Daddy.
Kinda, yeah. I mean it's like so it's like, okay, when it dies, the tank breaks, the spirit goes away, so like you can't get the scab back. Like that's I guess the exile kind of deal, whatever. What I like about it is you know, so often in Commander it's all about recursiveness, the ability to abuse the ability of your creatures that enter the battlefield, particularly if you're like green black or blue black. The ability to repeatedly get value out of a creature. And so this kind of removes the easiest way of kind of looping a creature onto the battlefield over and over and creating, you know, repetitive kind of grindy angles of attack, because you can't just like sacrifice it to something else and get it back over and over. Although you can still, you know, like repeatedly balance it with something like the number one card that I hate to see in Commander, which is Oh my goodness, I'm blanking on the name. Help me out here, Conley. It's the Deadeye Navigator. It's the one that's the Soulbond card that lets you blink over and over, or anything that bounces and returns it to your hand, that kind of stuff. Still works with it, but I really like kind of the idea is if you're going to print these cards that create recursion or like really great value, like being able to get like an instant sorcery or creature card in Commander is insane, because you're always going to have really good options, whether you're milling yourself or you're just getting something back that died earlier. Like it's almost like drawing a tutor in Commander, and I like that. That if you're going to print these things that get stuff back, having it have some limitations or making it a little more difficult to abuse that feels good. I really don't like seeing kind of the same game states happen over and over and over. And I know that's something R&D has looked at. Like, that's why we don't have stuff like buyback, and we don't have a lot of the repetitive things that used to kind of hang around in Magic. So like having these powerful effects that are really useful, but you only get them kind of like as a one shot, or you've got to go through a whole bunch of extra hoops to try to make them really, really good. I like that. Because I think the card's still really great for Commander, especially since it's a zombie. Like, you can just throw it into a blue-black zombie deck, and it's going to be amazing almost every time, but you don't get that abusiveness out of it, and I like that kind of dualism.
It is a cool card. At first, I admit, when I first read it, I got really confused. I thought when it died, you exiled the card that you picked, until I had to read the second time. I'm like, oh, it's just meaning it exiles it itself. I understand it now.
Yeah, that would be weird if it made you keep track of what you got back.
Yeah, that's why at first I was like, what? Oh, no, never mind. I'm making this much more complicated than it needs to be. I'm just going to go look at my fish lizards and be happy. So my other pick actually is not the Bounding Crisis, which is a fish lizard, which I thought was pretty cool. But I do like Thopters. And I also have a couple picks that are not my picks of the set, but they're going to go into my Mathematician's Wet Dream deck. So it would be my Commander picks. But I thought, let me pull up so I have the correct name, is Thopter Spy Network. I just thought this flavorful was interesting and kind of neat. Two in a blue, or two blue-blue enchantment, it's a rare. At the beginning of your upkeep, if you control an artifact, put a 1-1 colorless Thopter artifact creature token with flying onto the battlefield. And whenever one or more artifact creatures you control deals combat damage to a player, you draw a card. So I just thought it was just kind of a neat idea where, you know, on its own, it does almost nothing. I mean, literally, if you don't have another artifact out, this is a four mana dump on the board. As long as you have one artifact out, it tends to be kind of entertaining. And I like Thopters a lot.
All right, Tom, you like Thopters?
We good. I do.
So I'm not going to lie, Tom. Thopter Spy Network is one of the cards I really hope I open as like a pack one, pick one in a draft sometime, because I want to try out the Thopter deck, the blue-red deck, real bad.
Mm-hmm.
And this just seems like the most insane kind of rare bomb for it, because it's like, make a couple Thopters, and now my Thopters, like, I drop this, like, and then attack you. Great, I'm going to draw, like, three cards, and then next turn I'm going to get another one.
Yeah, it's Bitter Blossom at that point.
Yeah, it's like a Bitter Blossom that also draws me cards. Yeah. But it doesn't cost me life.
But if I understand the second clause in this, though, is I'm never going to draw more than one card. It just says whenever one or more artifact. Yeah, so it's a little different than
Coastal
Piracy or something like that.
It's one card per combat.
Yeah. So at first I was like, oh my god, it's Coastal Piracy, but all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute. Still really good, but...
Yeah, it's Bitter Blossom plus a Tome if you have Thopters going already, which is nice.
All right, that's my... Again, I'll do a couple of Commander personal picks, but I will hand it off to Conley.
All right.
Hey, isn't there a... Oh, no. Okay, so I thought there was an uncommon that let you tap two artifacts to have them deal damage, but it's gear per Aether Grid, but the Aether Grid, the enchantment, is what deals damage, so you can't use it to draw cards. Sorry.
Yeah, and this has to be combat damage for the way this one's worded.
Yeah.
All right, my next card is a simpler one, Gather the Pack. It's a uncommon, colorless and a green sorcery. We've seen this effect before. Reveal the top five cards of your library. You may put a creature card from among them in your hand. Put the rest in your graveyard. Also has Spell Mastery, though, which triggers if you have two or more instant sorceries in your graveyard. Keep in mind that does not count the cards you just revealed. But if you do have Spell Mastery, you could take up to two creatures from that pile and put them in your hand. So the reason I'm super excited about this card, is I think the graveyard deck is already pretty viable. It's already a deck that can exist in Standard, and it picks up a ton of along with other art decks, just pick up a ton of cool toys in this set. When I say they, I mean WotC, kind of did this thing with the set where they reinvigorate a ton of old archetypes, Devotion being in there, the graveyard decks being in there, enchantment strategies being in there, the artifact deck being in there. All these decks get all kinds of new toys. Like the graveyard deck gets this. It gets Erebos's Titan, which is a giant creature that can come back from your graveyard. It gets the 3/1 that can't block that comes back from your graveyard for black. There's all kinds of mill cards and just cool stuff you can do with your graveyard that should make the graveyard deck for the next 3 months at least extremely, extremely viable. In addition to that, like I said, you have the enchantment. You have a 2/2 for 2 that makes your enchantments cost 1 less, which is just insane.
And there's basically the new Opalescence, which is kind of wild.
Yeah, you have the new Opalescence that's also returning things to your graveyard, so it naturally gets back all your creatures. The enchantment deck should be extremely powerful for the next couple months because it still has Courser Crucifix and Vanishing Light and Eidolon of Blossoms and Doomway Chide and all those same cards. It just now has a bunch of other sweet enchantments to use. The artifacts deck, if you're going to try to use that, then Soul Artifact and stuff, now you have things to give your artifacts haste for 3 mana that we were just talking about. Like 3 mana, 1/3 that you get a 1/1 haste and make all your other artifact creatures have haste is like a very constructive playable card. In addition to that, there's Artifact Lords, like 3 mana, 2/3, your artifact creatures get +1/+1. That sounds pretty constructive playable to me, even though it's not, you know, the best Lord I've ever seen in my life. The fact that multiple of them stack well, he dodges a lot of common removal like Wild Slash and stuff. There's just a lot of cool things going on in this set. And this card in particular, I think, will really fuel graveyard strategies by being a card to play along with Commune of the Gods. It only costs 2 mana, but also sees 5 cards. So now you have Satyr, Wayfinder, and then the 2 5-drops, which is plenty of self-milling they're all very good. And in addition to that, the Spell Mastery on this, while it's not going to be active all the time because you're usually playing a creature-heavy strategy, whenever it is active, you turn your self-mill card into a divination, which is just insane. Like, drawing 2 and milling yourself 3 is, like, a very, very big deal for these types of decks. So I would be extremely surprised if we do not see some graveyard action in the next 3 months before Battle for Zendikar comes out.
Yeah, this is let me throw out a couple of the ones I thought were just kind of fun. For this is for Commander for the Mathematician's Wet Dream. So cards that just junk up math. They actually gave us a bunch of stuff that changes mana costs. As you kind of mentioned, the one that changes artifact or enchantment costs. We have Jace's Sanctum, which reduces its 3 and a blue in enchantment. Instant and sorcery spells you cast cost 1 less. And just randomly, whenever you cast an instant or sorcery spell, you get to scry 1. Which I just thought was an odd card. And for me, being a completely uneducated, modern, you know, vintage legacy player, one that it just smells like it's going to be horribly abused is Evolutionary Leap. Or it's kind of like the fixed pod.
It's more like the fixed survival of the fittest.
So, okay, that might be a better comparison. So just a green and a colorless enchantment, green, sack a creature, reveal cards, reveal cards from the top of your library until reveal a creature card. You put that card into your hand and the rest... Again, they fix this by it saying it goes to the bottom of your library, not...
Yeah, it goes to the bottom of your library and in a random order. So you can't even, like, if you have no creatures in your deck, the thing with Cascade back in the day was, theoretically, you Cascade, you Whiff, then you stack your entire deck. So they made you have to shuffle it, which is basically what you have to do with this card. You whatever you hit, however many creatures, you have to put randomly in the bottom of your deck. So this card is extremely hard to abuse. Like, the fact that you're getting random creatures in your hand, random cards around the bottom of your deck, you have to sack creatures to even get there. It's a card that I want to be good because it looks really cool, but I don't know if it's got the potential. But in casual circles, I'm sure it's awesome.
All right. So, yeah, actually, I got a couple more in there. Adam, is there any other ones that kind of had you excited?
No, Adam's going to stick hard and fast to his own rule, Tom. Don't.
2 only. I didn't make that rule, so I'm going to tromp right over it.
So there's one card that I'm a little excited about in terms of just kind of being maybe a little it'll go a little unappreciated, and it's Hangerback Walker.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I like it. Like, XX. It's XX. So you spend X mana twice, and you get you get an artifact creature construct that has that number of +1/+1 counters on it. When it dies, you put a 1/1 Thopter into play for each of the for each counter on it. But it's got the trying to remember its name, the Steel Overseer ability, where you one tap put a +1/+1 counter on it. Well, I guess Steel Overseer puts it on all your artifact creatures.
Yeah, what was this? This card actually existed. The 1-mana 1/1. It was like a couple core sets ago. It was just 1-mana 1/1, one tap, put a counter on it.
Yeah, and so that was like kind of like an uncommon that it was kind of fun to play with, because you've got it on turn one, like you could get it kind of pretty big, like if you curved out around it. But this is one of those things where I really like it as like that. I think it really shines in a commander deck as kind of like an insurance policy, right? So like in like a token deck, you pump a bunch of mana out into this, and you make like a, let's say you spend 10 mana on it, and it's a 5/5. Well, somebody immediately wraths the next turn to kill your token army, you still have 5/5s. If you block, and then this will be like the limited use for it. Like, you know, you get like, let's say you cast it for 4 with 2+1/+1 counters on it. You can block, pay and tap, put a counter on it, trade with a 3/3 or an X/3 or something, and come out with 3/1/1 flyers for that trade. It's just one of those really cool cards that I think is going to be maybe not a limited bomb, but just very, you know, it's
really strong. It should be really strong and limited. Just being colorless means it's a really high pick, because you really can't go wrong if you're going to play it in every deck or whatever.
Yeah. I think it's actually stronger in Commander than people give credit for it. I'm seriously considering giving it a try in just like a random Commander deck, just to see how the value of it works, because it just feels like that type of insurance policy that I like.
It's a construct. I've always liked constructs.
I'm waiting for a construct lord.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there technically is, because there's that shapeshifter artifact dude, and you choose a creature type, but like I want a lord for the constructs, like some sort of engineer.
You mean like if somebody would assemble a contraption, instead you assemble two of that contraption?
No, more like an artificer that just says constructs you control are.
I was just trying to rig there, Conley.
It's fine.
I'm from a design standpoint. I'm trying to think where, you know, you mentioned Demonic Pact. It seems like a really cool. Just flavor-wise, there's a lot of stuff happening on one card. It feels like the natural evolution, the next step, is almost like a choose-your-own-adventure type of that kind of card. Where you get, instead of just having a bullet list, I want like a branching tree diagram on my Magic card, where you can choose A or B, and then depending if I start with A or B, that's going to limit or give me more options down the road. It should be double-sided, so I can have, you know, even more options.
Tom, I'm glad you do podcasts and not design games.
I consult, Conley. You can always.
I mean,
affordable.
If you want to say what you do, what talking to me before the cast is consulting me, then we might need to talk about your resume, because I think you might be lying.
Are you sure you designed Rage, the collectible card game? Did you play Rage? Then yes, I did. So I just throw all these werewolf cards out that show things being ripped apart, right? Yeah, okay. It's like 52 card pickup with werewolves.
I mean, sounds like a good concept.
That was an incredibly... It was a bad collectible card game, but it was oddly fun to play. Did you ever play Rage?
I've never even heard of Rage.
Oh, God, it was great.
I remember the very first edition of the rules were insane, because it was literal free-for-all. It was fast as you could act.
Yeah, it's just like throw stuff down. It was great. It was incredibly gorgeous. Terrible artwork.
It was just free for all pogs, basically.
Kind of, but it kind of evolved. Initially, you literally just had like your guy werewolf, and you would evolve, and you'd like throw down attack cards based on like rend and rip and tear their flesh. But there was like, yeah, the rules like responding, it was just chaos. It didn't really matter.
In designer terms, we refer to that as slapjack. Whenever there's no turn based, like, okay, who goes here? And it's just like play whatever you can as fast as you can, it's just slapjack.
That should be, if you pulled up like the games in our dictionary, the Rage deck box should be the picture for slapjack then. Like how it was defined.
Fair.
But I have to admit, if I look at for fond memories of failed CCGs in the past, that one is still probably number one.
I mean, there are thousands of failed CCGs out there, so everybody's got, like, everybody also has that one failed CCG that nobody else knows about, that like them and their two buddies played and found in, like, you know, Walmart for $3 once. Yeah.
Okay, you brought up the topic. I picked mine. That's Rage, Conley.
Oh,
CCG of du jour.
I don't know. I have to think about it. I haven't thought about it. But I can't remember the names. The problem was I actually worked in a game store for in a comic book store for like 3 years. So we got all kinds of terrible like games where you were a child mummy who had come back to life and you were trying to find your parents. And then the ending to this game every single time, because it's a board game or whatever, the ending was you find out your parents had already died. So you came back from the underworld to reunite with your parents, and then you discover that they were also mummies, and so they were dead, and then your entire mission is... You're supposed to be happy because you get to live with them in mummy world, but that story is that you come back to life and find out...
You're all dead, basically. Yeah. Choose your own route to depression.
This entire board game, you were flipping cards. I don't think there was dice. There was something else, but you flip cards to move, and like the space... I can't remember what the spaces were, but they were like, discover a clue, your father's... Cologne is something. I can't remember. I'm going to Google it after the cast, and I can't remember the name, but it was absurd. We used to get demos of games in that never made it to sale. Like, they just literally came in as like a one of use for individual shop owners to show off, and if they didn't get enough good feedback or people didn't write in cards, then they would just never even get made. So we got to test all kinds of like terrible games, but I don't know. I don't think I could actually pick one, because all the games that I play hardcore were awesome. Like, I guess not awesome. Yu-Gi-Oh! Is not the greatest, but... Adam, do you play Yu-Gi-Oh? No. Tom probably played Yu-Gi-Oh!
No, I never got Yu-Gi-Oh! But I did play, like, Pokemon, and what else did I...
Oh, sure. Pokemon's actually a good game, though. Yeah, I don't think Yu-Gi-Oh! Is a very good game, but Pokemon's a pretty reasonable game.
Yeah, it was... I thought it was fun. The one, too, that was incredibly cheap, because it just bombed, was the Harry Potter CCG. It was actually kind of fun. It was very basic, but I found it entertaining.
The problem with TCGs when they bomb is you just don't get to keep, like... You can't. I mean, I guess you can play with what you have, but you don't get to like live the experience of a TCG.
The one exception would be the Star Trek, because that has lived on in kind of the community where there. I mean, new sets, expansions, tournaments, world championships are still going, and they've basically been officially kind of given, hey, it's okay to do this.
But how do you get? How do they get cards? Do you like go on Reddit and like download and
print? No, they have the. I could give you. It's the TrekCC.org. It's the Trek community. I can't remember what they call the CC stands for. I mean, you literally download a huge PDF. You print out your own full color art Star Trek cards. There's at least maybe 10 to 15 expansions. You can play first edition rules, second edition rules. Hell, they got the Tribbles. That was kind of that weird offshoot one that they had for a little while. It's amazing. Because honestly, from a flavor standpoint, this is blaspheme to say in a Magic podcast, the Star Trek, the Next Generation style CCG was amazing, where you had your planets, you moved your ship around, you were facing dilemmas and overcoming them with your astrometrics and my biology and my medical officer. It was perfect. I love that game.
All right.
The problem is nobody else plays it, so... You can't really play it by yourself. Well, apparently, a whole pile of them.
There's an entire community that's making the game.
And there's some of the community is actually based in kind of the Minneapolis area, but virtually these are like the world championship players. So they're very nice, but it's hard for them to kind of step back to play it like at a casual, I like to watch this on Netflix level of player, where I just want to have some Ferengis running around.
They're like me trying to deal with you.
Yeah, but even worse, because I'm bad at Magic. I'm even worse at the Star Trek. Yes, because right. I like to come up with like game scenarios where like I want one, like I try to make a deck where I won't even share with it. It dealt with with segregation.
The '90s card game that I still want to play is the Star Trek CCG that Decipher put out. Not actually play so much because it was like. Atrociously bad.
Are you talking about very complicated rules? Which one, first E or second?
There's only one. There's only one edition from Decipher.
This is the Decipher. Okay.
Yeah, the Decipher one, and it was just got way too complicated, way too fast. Very very unintuitive. Not very fun game when it came down to it. But what made it stand out was Decipher worked very very closely with LucasArts. And they put a lot of lore into the cards. And so, like, all the cards had, like, little bits of, like, lore information on them.
Star Trek Decipher, that was the big one.
That's Star Wars.
You're talking about Star Wars now or Star Trek?
Star Wars.
Star Trek because we were talking about Star Trek.
Yeah, you were talking about Star Trek. Oh, okay. I'm talking about the Star Wars
now CCG. We're good. So I was just like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
As soon as he said LucasArts, I knew he was talking about Star Wars, but I thought he also said Star Trek.
Okay.
Yeah, and so like, you know, they would have little bits and pieces that might matter for the rules in there, like spy and broker and stuff like that. But it was just really cool because, like, I was big on, like, I still am on Star Wars. Like, that is my sci-fi universe and, like, the thing that I love most for science fiction. And it was just, like, great to get, like, these little tiny lore bits and all this expanded universe kind of stuff in there. And it was, like, all officially canonized. Like before LucasArts was sold to Disney, like, all of the stuff and the lore that was in those cards was actually, like, still relevant in-universe. Like, that's what it was.
Like, there are little bits of stuff on there? Okay, interesting.
Yeah, and it was all, like, researched and tied in, and like, that was, like, a big thing for me. It was, like, every expansion, like, I got to see these little tiny details that were, like, part of it. And it's very much like, I think, why I liked, I definitely got into Magic at the right point. Like, buying a Tempest starter as, like, my first Magic purchase was because it was, like, all about the story and these characters, and, like, I kind of got sucked in that way too. So, like, that's what I miss about it. Like I wish the game was back, but with, like, rules and cards that actually, like, made sense and were fun to play. But just all the little lore bits were the best.
And I kind of like the asynchronous where you had the light side and the dark side decks, and they were, in some ways, had some kind of different types of rules to them. And you had ground and space spaceships.
Like, you couldn't really draft.
Oh, I know, I was, but
thing. Like, sealed deck was, like, just the worst. You know, it was really rough. Like, the game just, it's part of why it just died. It was
you can play sealed deck rage all day, man. Didn't matter.
Sealed deck rage. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Just throw those cards on the table and be like, I'm a werewolf.
Well, they would do. They had, like, sealed deck boxes coming, which came with, like, fixed good cards in them, like promo cards.
Ooh, Kevin Uxbridge.
And then it was like 12 booster packs because you needed that many because effectively, like, literally, you could only use half of them.
Yeah, it would be like trying to do that with, like, Hearthstone or whatever. If they were real cards and you open a pack and it had, you know, the class cards, you're like, well, I can't use.
I don't play a mage.
Cards. Yeah, I'm not playing mage. These things are bad. All right, moving on.
I can rip it up into a pile of dust, though. Oh,
yeah, yeah,
that's very good. Much.
All right, next magical topic.
Mulliganing.
That's not a word.
Mulliganing.
Almost got there.
Mulliganize.
Mulliganing could be a golf topic, though.
Mulligan. So it changed. To what has happened? Everybody, Patrick Chapin apparently birthed this idea from his cranium, like Athena from Zeus's head. A new mulligan rule came out.
He's been pitching this for a while, apparently. Basically, the new rule is pretty simple. If you mulligan once, twice, 30 times, it doesn't matter. After you're done keeping your hand, so if you mulligan a six, then you decide your six card hand is bad, you would have to mulligan to five before doing anything. But once you keep your hand, once you're like, okay, I'm keeping these five cards, I'm keeping these six cards, you then get to scry one. That's the rule. That's basically it.
I mulligan to six, then before I decide to keep the hand, I get to look at the top card in my library to make sure.
After you keep the hand. You have to keep your hand and then you scry.
How does this help me?
It does help you. So clearly, you know that...
I'm getting extra information, but it doesn't actually... I'm not getting card advantage or anything else with it.
That is true, but scry means you get to put it on the bottom if you want.
Oh, okay, so this is true scry. I thought you meant you just got to peek at the top.
No, this is scry, so you get to choose to put that card on the top or bottom. So you are filtering. Basically, the rule is intended to, or at least this is my interpretation of its intention, is to have less non-games of Magic. So, games happen where you get stuck on three and you do what, you know, you fight tooth and nail and you come up short, but you don't get your fourth land, and that happens, and that's a game. But the games where you mulligan to four and you just don't make your second land drop and you play zero spells and your opponent runs you over in five turns, those games are also not the most exciting in the world. So this is supposed to kind of cut off those extremes to some degree. It's clearly not going to solve everything. It's a very, very small tweak to the percentages of what non-games exist, but non-games are already in a small percentage. You know, most games you play, or most games of Magic you're going to play, you do something. You know, you might be behind, you might be at a disadvantage, whatever, but you have a game of Magic. But this is not intended to say, hey, you will never get mana screwed, you'll never get mana flooded, because those are both things that exist in the Magic world, and whether you like it or not, do define the game, and they are an integral part of why we enjoy the game. But this is just to say, hey, there's the super extreme times that you really, really hate, and you sat down for 20 minutes and you walked away a sad person. We don't want those to happen quite as often. So, you know, if you mulligan to 6, you mulligan to 5, and you're going to struggle on your land drops, or you're going to, you know, have 5 lands in your hand, and you're like, man, I kept this hand because I really need to make land drops. But if I draw a 6 land next turn, like, there's just no chance I'm winning this game. You get to at least take a look and be like, okay, let's put that 6 land to the bottom and have a chance at, like, having a better game. So it just should be a very, very small tweak to how the actual percentages, the data that comes back for, like, did this person actually play Magic this game? Yes or no? But at the same time, the feel when you mulligan, it should be a little less painful, which is nice. And it just should just make a couple more games of Magic, especially on camera, a little more exciting to watch.
From a more professional side, are you at all worried that now we're adding in more potential times that, with all the cheating scandals, that people are now manipulating their decks, moving cards around?
This is another time where you could cheat, yes, but I don't think, like, nobody who didn't cheat before is going to start cheating now because this rule existed. So,
okay. It sounds cool. I'll be interested to sort of see what the adoption rate is for casual Magic, where, I mean, unless you're following the sites, you may not even know this happened. It seems like a cool idea. I think a lot of people have kind of done this as a house rule, so it doesn't seem like it's too big of a change.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very natural. Like, I know I've done it with my buddy. Like, when I would play Magic with a friend over lunch, we would eat lunch and build a sealed deck and play a match all in 45 minutes. And if you've ever built a sealed deck and tried to play a match, you know that the times add up to much more than that. So we were pretty quick, and that was one of our shortcuts, was like, okay, we mulled a 6. If we want to mulligan again, but, like, the difference between, like, is it a land on top or is it, like, a relevant spell? Like, we would just do the little peeky, and, like, if it didn't work, like, we'd shuffle up and try to go to 7 again because we just wanted to play Magic. And, like, that was the whole goal of, like, that little peek, was, like, are we going to actually play something? Like, it wasn't, you know... It wasn't going to determine the outcome in the match, but it was, like, enough to be like, hey, are we actually going to, like, have fun? So, like, I'm a big fan of this rule. I had a chance to play with it immediately last week with a bunch of guys. We did, a 5v5 Pro Tour, or draft with the Pro Tour cube that Eric Klug runs. So it was super fun, and the rule felt really nice. A bunch of really sharp players were there doing it, and, I mean, it feels very good. I don't think it wildly changed anything per se, but I think it helped make more of the Magic feel good. And even if that's all it really does in the end, it doesn't actually change, you know, the games where you mulligan to 5 and you get overrun and limited. Like, peeking at the scrying 1 probably won't make the biggest difference all the time, but it makes it feel like you've had more of a chance to do something. And I think that feeling is a net positive for any game.
Yeah, I agree. So also worth noting, the rule: do not go to your local game store on Friday and expect this rule to be in effect. It will not go in effect until the Pro Tour, and at the Pro Tour, only the Pro Tour will have it in effect. It's still not going to be public. They're going to basically, I'm sure, get feedback from pros, get feedback from judges, get data, and then they'll probably announce a full-scale launch shortly after the Pro Tour, I would imagine.
Really? That's confusing. It seems like we're better just to sort of pull the Band-Aid off and...
And that's my biggest problem with how this rule's being kind of tested, because that's all it really is this coming Pro Tour is a big guinea pig, you know, a big lab rat fiesta. You know, I don't know what you want to call it, but, like,
lab rat fiesta. I like, you know, that's a show title.
Like, I don't know what you
lab rat fiestas.
Yeah, experiment. Like speaking as a player, right? So, like, I do a lot of coverage and write for Wizards and stuff like that. So, like, you know, again, anybody who thinks I talk on behalf of the company, you're crazy.
You're 100% a mouthpiece, man. 110%.
Yeah, totally. So, like, just speaking as a player and a viewer, like, I wish that, like, every other major rule change for Magic, right? Like, when they took damage off the stack, when they made Modern a format, and it was, like, you know, hey, this is a thing now, and it's going to be a Pro Tour Philly, but it was like an official format, and you can schedule this for your stores, and this is a thing that's going to be at Grand Prix, and like they rolled it out, like it's just this is what it is, right? So like, let's say they made the combat damage on the stack rule, and it turned out it made the game like net worse, like it was actually way more destructive than they thought. It didn't actually make the game better; it made it worse, and players revolted. Like they would just roll it back. Right, it's just a rule. Like they just change the rules. Like we do this all the time. Like we update the rules every set. You know, there's new rules in the game and how stuff works. So like that's the thing that really bugs me about this is like it's great that they're willing to say, hey, look, we want to get experience of this. We want to see how it works with some of the best players of the game. We want to ideally create better viewing at home because people are going to see better games of Magic because ideally players are going to make the most of that rule change. But I don't think I don't think the Pro Tour is the best place to guinea pig it like this one because it's just standard, right? Like I don't think the Mulligan rule really affects anything other than possibly Eternal formats. Like I really don't see the Mulligan and Scry one really making that dramatic of a difference unless you're playing something like Vintage or Legacy or Modern.
For any individual game, it could, So the theory here, to expand on what Adam's saying, in older formats, finding any individual card is significantly more powerful. That's why tutor effects are stronger. It's why cards like Brainstorm Plus, Fetchland interactions are really strong because you're finding basically broken cards. Broken cards exist in these formats. Not all cards are created equal in these formats. So finding a broken card and drawing it is very important. So scrying one can have impacts on things like, did I find my Delver of Secrets on turn one? Did I flip my Delver of Secrets on turn one because I was on the play and got to see that there was an instant on my deck, played turn one Delver, and then knew it flipped? So there's like small interactions like that can come up. In Standard, you're less likely to see those things and more likely to see, did this player make his third land drop because he mulliganed to five and he got to scry one and he put his Elspeth on the bottom and the rule was awesome? But you're only going to see that in like individual games. You're not going to see like certain cards get more powerful, certain archetypes get more powerful, certain players get more powerful. I'll expand on that player's part in a second. But at least in terms of the format as a whole, you're not going to see any one thing take advantage of this. It's just the games are going to be slightly better. I do think it's strange that especially they're testing on the Pro Tour because scrying one is a decision. It's a point where a better player gets to gain an edge over a worse player because a decision is being made. If they make the correct decision, using information that generally neither player has at their fingertips. It's all estimating and guessing what's going to matter in this game. If the better player makes the correct decision, they're going to gain more value off of this rule than they otherwise would have. So let's say we both mulligan to six and I'm a better player than you. I actually have an edge now because of this rule that I did not have before. When we mulligan to six before, we had one more decision, which was, do I want to mulligan again? Yes or no. Now we have two more decisions, which is, do I want to mulligan and get yes or no? And do I want to put this card on top of my library? So I now have two chances to already get a leg up on you before you even started playing. So I actually think this rule could have a sort of a global impact of better players getting slight edges in games where both players mulligan. But again, that is already kind of a small demographic of games. But it's weird because at the Pro Tour, we're not going to see that necessarily as much because these are already all really, really good players. And that would be one of the things I would want to test is what players are gaining advantages out of this. And I don't think the Pro Tour is a great place to test that. So it is kind of interesting that they would not just like go, hey, at FNM. Like, the thing is, everybody already knows about the rule. People are excited to test with it. People want to test with it. And a lot of people think they are test, like they are going to play with it. So, like, why not implement it? It is kind of weird. Like, there are certainly stores this Friday that people are going to be scrying one, like, because, you know, there's not a judge standing at every table at F&M. Like, there are definitely people who are just going to be scrying one when they mulligan, and nobody's going to correct them. But, oh, well.
Yeah, so, like, that's, like, the crux for me as a player. Is like, I think this is a net positive for, like, most people that would play the game. And I'd like to just see that rolled out. Like, even if it was terrible. Like, we found out 6 months in, whoops, this is a mistake. Like, just undo that. Like, this is a rules change. This is a policy change. This isn't like printing a card, right? Like that's what I really don't get about not rolling this change out at the pre-release. Is like it's not like you print a card and you can't unprint it later and you have to ban it, and then it like gets very weird about like the whole, well, can I trust Magic as like something I can buy and play with, you know, competitively? Like there's not even a trust issue. It's just simply, you know, the worst case is, you know, this rule had an unintended effect of creating unfair gameplay advantages for players, you know, that it created a skill gap that wasn't there before. Like, that's the worst case scenario, and it's so noticeable they have to roll it back. Okay. Like, or I don't think anybody's going to argue about that. Like, okay, we want Magic to feel like a more fair game where people can play with each other. Okay.
Or maybe they find a happy medium where they go, okay, we discovered that by everyone playing and getting and writing in their thoughts, we learned that this rule is not good for Vintage and Legacy, so we're going to revert back to old Mulligan rules for those two formats, and every other format will get to use this rule. Like, they could have done things like that, but the thing is, at the Pro Tour, nobody's playing Vintage, nobody's playing Legacy. Like, nobody's even testing this rule out in those formats unless they're doing it on their own free will. So it's kind of interesting that they didn't just put this out there for everybody. We're like, hey, give us your feedback as a group of, you know, like-minded individuals. And instead, they're sampling from the tippy top of the mountain, which is fine. Those are all intelligent people that are going to have good thoughts, and I'm sure they're going to give good feedback. And I'm almost 100% positive this rule is going to be put into effect after the Pro Tour, which is the strangest part. It's like, if this rule did not get put into effect, I would be extremely, extremely surprised. Like, why announce it? Why talk about it? Like, why? Like, there's very little reason to do that if you don't plan on putting it into place as is. Like, it would take a very big argument from some pro that somehow hasn't been discovered yet for them to not roll this out. So it is kind of strange that it's just not out already, but you know, a month from now it should be out. We'll see.
And so the other thing about this rule that that really stands out to me, I guess, as a player that's also acutely aware of some of the things that go into coverage projection. So for example, at the Pro Tour, they almost never show the players mulligan decisions, right? They'll typically go, you know, particularly during, like, think about, like, the top eight playoff on Sunday, you know, they'll have the booth conversation and a lot of context and a lot of what matters and really breaking it down to try to make sure that anybody who's, like, kind of into Magic and is just watching this, like, gets, like, what's going on, feels like they can understand what's
going on. Meanwhile, while they're doing that, I, as a player, am actually taking my mulligans off screen. Like, you don't even see this happening. I'm already making all my mulligan decisions. Once I'm done mulliganing, I tell a spotter that I'm done mulliganing. My opponent tells a spotter that they're done mulliganing. They then ask to see our hands. We usually raise them up or whatever, or they'll do some detective work, and they'll figure out our hands that we're keeping after our mulligans are complete. And then we send it back to, like, the guys at the desk, and they start going back into it. So then Adam takes it from there.
Yeah, and so the thing is like, you know, I feel that there's a very high possibility, and I think it'd be very smart on you know, the production part. Like, I don't know how it's going to go down, but, like, I feel like it'd be smart. Like, effectively, this rule should theoretically be invisible, right, to viewers at home. Because at first, that was one of my big concerns, was, like, it's going to be super confusing, like, watching these players play, like, actually do stuff physically different and, like, do this, like, extra card thing that, like, I've never seen anybody do before in a game. But I think that's going to be invisible. Like, people aren't going to see that really happening, which makes sense. Like, there won't be that disconnect of the rules. Like, hey, I play Magic, but, like, I've never heard of that before. Like, that shouldn't necessarily be a thing. Like I feel like that's how they'll handle that. But I feel like the players coming back from the event, and the players that, you know, the player that wins or makes top four, like, they're going to talk about those decisions. Like, I mulliganed to six. I saw this card on top. And I had to make a choice. Do I keep that or do I send it to the bottom? And, like, that keep or send to the bottom, like, is going to feel like a very...
You keep it.
I mean, it's going to feel like a big decision, right? Because, like, somebody is going to say, you know what? I decided to be greedy, keep it on top, and kept this, like, really powerful sideboard card that I brought in a third game, and it paid off totally for me versus, like... You know, so it didn't, and we're not going to see those type of decisions on camera. And so I'm just really curious, like, so let's say this rule gets rolled out later, like, how would that impact, like, viewing at home? Like, knowing that somebody kept a very specific sideboard card on top in game three feels like something that should be useful at home. So, like, are they going to start reporting that information that now, or, like, are we going to get that as a viewer? Like, we have, like, a little thing that says, like, this is the top card of their library, this is, like, what they're going to draw when they untap. Like, I don't know. Like it just seems like, if it's going to be, like something that's the decision and is arguably important, like, is that going to be captured or relayed in some way?
I kind of wish, even if they didn't shoot it live, like, even if they didn't have a camera over the player's shoulder while they're making decisions, I kind of wish they kept track of each hand that the player viewed, so afterwards we had that data, like, this player, more than just this player mulliganed to five and won the game. It's like this player mulliganed to this six land hand plus this card and then this six card hand And then kept this five card hand and saw this card on top and did this with it with that. Obviously, that's a ton of data for people, and I understand there's all kinds of logistics issues and getting people to actually do this is tough. But if we actually had that kind of data, if we got to see snapshots of hands even after the fact, if like you know they're playing their first couple turns and Rich Hagen's talking about you know whatever nonsense is going on because they're playing you know temples and it's very slow moving or whatever, he could be like, yeah, we know he mulliganed a six, and here's the seven card hand he shipped back. Now that not only do they have some stuff to talk about, which is kind of cool at the beginning of a game, but we get to kind of get into their minds a little bit. Now the scrying on the top at the beginning of the game matters a lot more because we already see them. Like everybody plays a tempo on turn one anyway. So a lot of the times, basically all that's going to happen is we're going to have missed their first scry and then see their second scry on the first turn of the game because they're temploing. But actually the temple thing is a big change for this rule. If you mulligan a six and you scry a card to the top and your first turn play was supposed to be temple, it changes, that changes the value of that play a lot because now you're the scry you were going to get is useless. So the only value you're gaining is putting land in play tap. So I do expect, at least for this Pro Tour, while temples are illegal, for that to be a pretty big thing, is players be like, or some players might not even realize it, where they scry and then they keep a two temple hand and then they realize their hand wasn't as good as it actually was because one of those temples is actually dead and blah, blah, blah. So it'll be really interesting to see little small things like that. And it'll be interesting to see if WotC puts a magnifying glass. Like for all we know, maybe they pull the curtain back and they're like, let's watch their mulligan decisions now. That'd be kind of interesting, at least. I don't know if I would enjoy it or not. Maybe it'd be really boring, but it would at least be different. So I'm hoping that they're willing to kind of play it by ear more so than this announcement, since as Adam pointed out, just not releasing it to the public is pretty weird. Like I can't even remember the last. When they did the Paris Mulligan rule, was that for only Paris, right?
Mulligan.
That was the last time.
That was, you know, that was like 16 years ago.
Yeah, 15,
it wasn't that long
years.
Into the Pro Tour that they like fixed that. Like it was like a, oh, this really bad rule about keeping hands. Why don't we change it to something that makes the game a lot more fun for people to play? Wow, brilliant. So like, you know, I guess the counterpoint is like, if this dramatically changes, like if it makes that skill gap just absolutely brutal, you know, not pushing this out on everyone is certainly going to be a net feel good. But I strongly suspect the opposite. Like I think unless you're playing like Vintage and or you know, I think maybe Legacy and Modern, where that individual card power is just so high, it's just going to make Magic better. Like it felt really good to like go to a six card hand, mulligan away, you know, a fourth land and end up and then draw gas out from there.
Yeah, like most of the, in most scenarios at FNM level and below, this rule is simply you've mulliganed, now do you have a land on top of the library or not? Like that's what it comes down to. It's just you get to know. Hooray.
All right. I mean it was interesting. I feel like the messaging is going to be difficult because if you were maybe sort of a casual peruser of Magic news, again, you would read this and be like, oh, there's the new mulligan rule. I'll start using that. And
well, one thing that helped is it did make Scry an evergreen mechanic. So Scry will all be around theoretically in every set from here on out, or at least until they change the evergreen mechanics. So as long as that's true, if the player basically has to know that what Scry does to play Magic anyway. So it's not like they're getting a brand new concept. I mean, they're basically just being told to Scry one, which if you had no idea what Scry was, is a lot harder to wrap your head around than just, you know, this game action that you do all the time anyway.
All right, anything else, guys, before we are well an hour in. We did pretty well.
I think I'm set.
Do I get to tell my top of World War II story?
All right. I'll allow it. Okay, it's up to Adam's adjudicator, but I'll allow it.
Pretty sweet. So my wife likes to make photo books where you can, you know, do them online. There's like Snapfish and a number of plates, Shutterfly, where you pull your photos, you can make nice books, you do this for the girls. So we should do it.
I have SF as the formula, like word that starts with F joined with word that starts with S, word that starts with F.
Pretty much, yeah. Snapfish, Shutterfly. Not sure why, but that's why I love more, actually. So we started doing this for like relatives. Like it was for her grandmother. This was her husband. He was in World War II. She had all these like random photos and journals. We scanned them all in, made a photo book. We have a pile of them in our living room. Our oldest discovered one of these. It's like, oh, who, you know, this is the age of nonstop talking, 1,000 questions. You know, who is this? You know, oh, it's you know, great grandpa. Why is he on a ship? Okay, you know, she also understands, like, you know, kind of fighting, you know, from like Disney books and things like that is usually an antagonist that you are battling. So I wasn't going to go down the road of describing World War II, but my wife decided to. This was at dinner with Grandma and Grandpa there. So
she was looking at the books in front of Grandma and Grandpa?
Yeah, I mean, we met with, I mean, this is her Grandma and Grandpa, so it's Holly's parents. So it's So, I mean, it's a very cool book. Is the, probably the neatest thing they scanned in was, like, their, basically the shipboard newsletter. So it was, like, handwritten and published on the ship. So it was interesting. It was, like, all handwritten stuff by the sailors, and they did, like, drawings and, like, their own comics. It was, I thought that was the most fascinating part. But Holly decided to delve into the reason we were in World War II is that we were fighting Hitler. So now we're trying to describe Hitler to a 3.5-year-old. Adam has the correct response of like, oh my God, this is a minefield. So eventually we went through all this talk. So at the dinner, it's like, you know, Amelia, what kind of, what'd you get out of this? She's like, Hitler was an evil witch who hurt a lot of people and smokes a pipe. We're like, I'm not sure where the pipe smoking part comes from, but we did mention she had learned a few weeks earlier that smoking is bad. We think that's the connection. But I did like that Hitler was an evil witch.
I mean, that's not the most inaccurate statement in the world.
No, but we do have our phones on silent for that first call from daycare about your kid is talking about Hitler.
most yeah, that's an awkward age. I don't even know what the right age to learn about Hitler is, but it can't be 3.5.
Honestly, when she's 4 and you can do like Pol Pot. I mean, you know, maybe like every 6 months we throw in a new dictator just to make sure she's fully educated. Atrocities of the human race.
Pretty soon explain the benefits of communism to her.
Everything equal? Sure. Sounds perfect to me. That's how I run my household, basically. It's like a communist commune. That's not your allowance. That's daddy's allowance.
Yeah, that's the way that relationship works.
My lawnmower. It's our lawnmower.
All right, Adam's shell-shocked that he has a 3.5-year-old. Like, he's trying to debate right now calling Child Protective Services.
I'm more shocked that Adam hasn't discussed Hitler with his children.
I don't know if my dad has literally ever discussed Hitler with him. In 28 years on this planet, I don't know if my father's ever sat me down and had a Hitler talk.
You should call him, Dad, why did you not tell me that Hitler was real? I thought he was just a character in Wolfenstein.
Introducing my daughter to the horrific atrocities that mankind is capable of isn't something that I feel is necessarily age appropriate. We're still working on things like basic personal responsibility, like don't pull on your brother's hair.
Ooh, there you go. That's a big one.
Or yell at
him. Don't
like
genocide.
We're working on that before we get into the eugenics and mass slaughter. That's a couple chains up the atrocity. Yeah,
at least four.
We're starting with simple atrocities.
You can you start with finger foods, using a fork, and then Hitler. It's kind of a
Wait, you use Hitler to eat food?
No, it's just that's the next sort of developmental step.
But you went from with the
I was just trying to say the basic steps that you hit early in life.
All right, we've now talked about Hitler for a record 5 minutes straight, and that has to be the time where our podcast ends.
We're done.
MTG Pokemon now for
Hitler. Yeah, with more World War II discussions, but no Confederate flags. Mm-mm. No. Okay, so here's a Confederate flag story that came up about 2 days ago. So we're
not doing a Confederate flag.
No, it's not actually about Confederate flags.
What we're doing, Tom, is we're doing the outro. You had Hitler.
Let's leave the Confederate flag story right now. So there's a house. It's we just kind of walked around the block. It's around the lake, and people aren't familiar with the Confederate flag. So I'm assuming some people may not look. You know, it's red with like a blue
Everybody
sort of white.
Everybody currently knows what the Confederate flag is.
Some people aren't, because that's where the story goes. So we're going around, and Holly, a couple days ago, come home, and she was livid. She's like, some, you know, basically asshat out there, you know, in her neighborhood, has a Confederate flag on their house. I was like, that's a little surprising. I mean, this is after everything has happened, and this is the Midwest, North, where you would never tell somebody that they're being racist, but you would judge them, you know, from afar over dinner. So, but eventually, a couple days ago, she's like, okay, you have to go see the flag. I mean, Confederate flag, like, I thought she was going to make me stop and, like, try to have a discussion with this person that you can't have a Confederate flag in their house. So we rolled up, and it's like, you know, that's actually the Norwegian flag, which has some similarities to it. It's red with a blue-white, like, plus sign. But we did get to learn that, you know, the Norwegian flag looks similar but is different from the Confederate flag.
That's a confirmed fact. Norwegian flag is not Confederate.
It is not the Confederate flag.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
So I almost got into a fight with a neighbor over for Sven Svensson there was about to get accosted over his Confederate flag in his house. Like,
oh. Why do you have to be the most stereotypical? We're talking about racism, and you call the Norwegian guy Svensson and then or whatever. Come on.
All I can think of is Oaken from Frozen. Oh.
That's hello. Also a stereotype.
Hello.
He rides Yoo-hoo. On loops.
Yoo-hoo. Pick someone right. Blowout.
We're done here. We're done here.
All right. If you want to email us, email me to yell at me and not to yell at Adam or Conley. It is mtgpopery@gatheringmagic.com. You can also find us on Twitter. I am at @PSGReader. I don't do anything else, so I have like 2 followers. Conley?
He replies to my tweets that he knows nothing about with...
I do love to reply to your League of Legends tweets because it's all like...
gibberish.
What has jungle channel TP...
No, normally when people don't understand the language inside of a tweet, they just ignore it and they move on. But you, no, you have to figure out what way you could contort it and get your little quip in.
Hey, I thought the name for my toilet paper review blog was pretty good, the cheat
sheet. It is the cheat sheet. It's a good one. Yeah. All right, but if you would like to quip about any of my things I say on Twitter, you find me at Conley81. Also, articles on TCG Player, Deck Doctor on channelfireball.com. Set review on TCG Player next week. Monday through Friday. And that's about it for me.
So I'm Adam Szymborski.
Yeah,
I do a whole bunch of stuff, a whole bunch of places, really just to Gathering Magic and the official MagicTheGathering.com website. You can find me every Thursday on MagicTheGathering.com at Command Tower. I talk about Commander, obviously. I am also on GatheringMagic.com, so I do. I should have a cube update. It's a pretty sizable one that includes both Modern Masters 2015 edition and Magic Origins. I did a big cube revamp. I'm very excited by where it's going, and I got some awesome feedback from one of the Canadian judges, Kyle Rick, that runs a bunch of drafts up in Canada with some of those guys. So very, very interesting feedback, something that I've kind of had in the back of my mind, but came to the forefront now, so I'm going to make that change as well. So if you're looking forward to cube updates, I'll be coming out with that soon. You can angrily yell at me about my lack of cube updates on Twitter, @_Stibs, STYBS. If you read Command Tower, every week I've got a question. You can email me the answer to the question there, commandtowerstibs@gmail.com. So that's a good way to get a hold of me there.
That's what his wife calls him, too.
Oh, wow. There's so many places I could go with climbing the Command Tower. Oh, man. What's the view from up there? So many good things.
Oh my God. Sorry, I had to.
Who's your general?
I had to.
See, call me your general.
But if you want to email all of us, and that's probably really just Tom, it is again mtgpopery@gatheringmagic.com. And we also have a Twitter that Tom...
Oh, God, this is a horrible mental image. Oh.
So @mtgpopery on Twitter is definitely a great way where I know this. I'll see the tweets at us. But it's definitely Tom answering them.
Yeah, I know. I've literally never answered anything ever. So if you want to reach me, do not send it to MTG Popery.
Yeah, that's why I stopped putting the little parentheses like Tom. I think most people, by the content of the reply, usually would ascertain.
It's gibberish, and yes, it's usually you.
Yeah, Tournament Ultrasoft.
But that's it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, guys. That was pretty fun. And we're hopefully back on a more regular basis. Peace out.